The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on, too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary.
Merry Christmas, subscribers! Proud to bring you a Dunked On tradition to do a podcast on the Christmas games on Christmas Day. And interesting slate, probably, I would say, second best game of the day, at least on paper, Philly and New York, given the lack of absences relatively for either side.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I mean, some of them, the absences will be notable. Of course, we'll talk about that. But I was interested in this game for a couple different reasons. One of them being some of the tactical wrinkles, what these teams try to take away, what they try to do, and defending the pick and roll for the Knicks. They've done a pretty good job limiting opponent shots around the basket overall this year, but 3-point has been a story for both these teams. And I would say there were tactical wrinkles that were extremely important in this game, especially in the Sixers' run, which I think is the place to start here. This Philadelphia did not lead in the first three quarters of the opening game, but they took a 24-9 run to start the fourth, which pushed them into what was eventually a very insurmountable lead. It was 116-102, I think, at that point.
Yeah, and they started it with Joel Embiid on the bench. It was interesting that late in the first, they went to a group without Harris, Harden, or Embiid. That didn't go as well, but they had Harden and Harris out there, George Niang as well, and the Sixers started going crazy from three. Niang had 4 3-pointers in the period, and the biggest thing that stuck out to me, and this player had a really nice game on the offensive end most of the way, Julius Randle, but it was the same problem, Danny, that we saw in that NBA cast game that we did where they couldn't guard a pick and pop four man with Julius Randle.
Or at least chose not to do the switch. I mean, there are times where I thought that the threat assessment by, I guess you would say that's Tibbs, was, you know, I think at times you can roll those dice. Harden isn't getting to the basket all the way in the same way. Also, they have pretty good help. So, I mean, I think they should have gone to that more, but the lack of comfort there, and it led to the Knicks conceding all of these pick and pop shots. And as you tweeted at the time, it directly paralleled a game that changed in the, I believe it was the early fourth quarter. It did it a couple times, and that was when we did Cavs Knicks for the strategy stream, and it was these Donovan Mitchell, Kevin Love pick and pops, and Love, a wonderful shooter, George Niang, a wonderful shooter, and they're just getting wide open looks, and it'll come in at other points as well. Wide open shooter, good looks, and they converted those, swung the game.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. They eventually went to switch that after Niang, I think it hit his third three of the quarter, and then Harden actually got past Randle and finished. But overall, I thought it was the case for both teams, but particularly for the Knicks, where they just could not keep their hands out of the cookie jar. Tom Thibodeau decried the reckless reach-ins, and that was at the start of the fourth quarter in his interview, and things got worse from there. So obviously Harden and Embiid very reliant on getting to the foul line. That's been a big theme, and Embiid 15 free throw attempts, Harden 11. And so many of those just came out of the kind of BS foul drawing moves that those guys like to do. But when you reach in on them, you give them that opportunity. And certainly a big part of why they're able to draw fouls is because of the threat that they present. But for a team that thrives on discipline, Tom Thibodeau clearly in his preparation was all over the idea that you can't foul these guys and you can't reach in, but they just weren't able to do it. So it ended up being 26 of the Sixers, 29 free throw attempts for those guys as well. As bad as it got, though, offensively, or I should say as bad as it got for the Knicks with Philly's offense, they only put up 24 in that period.
Right.
It was really the New York offense that totally fell apart in the fourth.
That's a great point. And during that fourth quarter, you know, I've brought it before at times when the Knicks have been lucky, and Philly has been the most fortunate team so far this year on opponent three-point shooting, not judging for contested, uncontested, just pure numbers. New York 0-for-8 on threes, mostly above the break, and then they were in total 0-for-10 on jump shots and just didn't get a ton around the basket either. I believe they didn't get to the line a ton in that fourth quarter either. So the wells, all of the wells basically dried up at the same time for them. And yeah, I think that's a really good point. I talked about the 24-9 and we were focused on the 24 at first, but those 9 points, that's a huge, huge problem too.
And it was a stark contrast with what took place in the first three quarters, because the Knicks had a 141 offensive rating in the first three quarters and the Sixers 139.7. And a big part of that was just the three-point shooting. And then the Knicks failed to make a three in the fourth. They only had, I think, 3 field goals in the whole fourth, or at least during the competitive portion of the fourth. And the Sixers, of course, they were able to maintain their scorching three-point shooting throughout in that fourth quarter with the 4 threes, all of them by Niang. So any other kind of big themes that stuck out to you here?
Well, I think we talked about him in the negative end, which is unfortunate, though he earned it defensively. But I thought Julius Randle putting together that 35-8, like it's not always in the ways that you and I, you know, love focusing on for great offensive players. You know, Randle did get a fair amount around the basket. The jump shot, I think, was better today than it has been in most games overall. But I thought he did a good job offensively, kind of taking a lot of those shots. I mean, he took 24, RJ Barrett took 21, and Jalen Brunson took 19. So the Knicks, what we think of as their best offensive players, or at least conceptually, they took a vast majority of the attempts in this game.
Yeah, and it has, as they've shortened the rotation, I think been clarifying for them to focus the offense mostly through those three players, and we'll see what happens when Obi Toppin comes back, but he's not going to probably be a guy who's going to change that. You'd think a lot of his minutes would come at the expense of these two big lineups with Jericho Sims, which we can talk about a little bit more. Unfortunately, a big part of the Knicks' struggles were Jalen Brunson appeared to have some sort of a right hip injury, which he was favoring throughout the second half. Eventually went to the locker room. He was fantastic overall in his 35 minutes with 23 points and 11 assists. I like that he's been a little bit more aggressive shooting the three-pointer than he was in Dallas when the defense goes under. It was more like he would take them wide open, and now he's taking a little bit more on the move, which is great to see. His floater game was working really well, but they really could have used him down the end because they didn't have the organization. They ended up having to play Barrett 43 minutes, and he's been with the bench, and he had 44 in their last second loss to the Bulls on Friday, but ended up struggling to 6 out of 21 and 17 points in all. But getting back to Randle, his game, he had all 4 of his three-pointers in the first half, 3 of them in the first quarter. And what did you think about the way he was getting his points in that first half? And while the comeback did happen partially with him on the floor, he was plus 5 in 40 minutes.
I did think that he would. So with Randle, I still don't love the mechanics like of a pull-up shot for him. I don't think he quite has that in his bag. But if you give him a spot up and Randle has his feet under him, I'd have to look at the numbers on it, but I feel a lot better about that shot. And of those first few he hit, I think at least 2 of them were feet under him, just take a good shot.
You know, the 2 that he took right away, I noticed he's actually like kind of on the move going to his left. But
I was thinking more of the later ones.
Yeah, maybe he's more comfortable with that shot. I mean, there are sometimes guys are just comfortable with the shots that they're comfortable with, and it wouldn't necessarily be a good shot for some guys, but it's an okay shot for him. But yeah, I mean, he's kind of settled in this year where I thought he would be last year, and he's been much better than last year on both ends. Overall, though, it was interesting. I liked the most what he was doing being 6 of 7 at the rim. And he was able to do that by hitting some threes early and then getting PJ Tucker to close out to him and getting strong left-handed drives to the basket. And Julius Randle, I think we've kind of forgotten that he's a pretty good athlete for the body type that he has at 6'10", kind of strong guy, that he actually can get some pretty good pop around the rim. We just haven't seen it as much because they've been ISOing him a lot. They haven't had great spacing around him. And so he's had to pull up a lot, or he's really finished in a contested paint. And I thought the Knicks spacing overall was a lot better. They've cut out a lot of those mid ranges. That's the other thing with Randall this year. And in this game was, unless he had a mismatch that they kind of flowed into in a semi-transition situation, they really didn't post him up very much, which was good to see. He ended up having to take six mid rangers, which is maybe more than you'd like, but he had it rolling in this game. And the Knicks with 12 mid rangers, that's more than they normally take. They like to more take floaters and threes at this point. So the Sixers were able to impact them a little bit more as the game went on, and particularly in that fourth quarter once the three-point shooting cooled off a little bit.
We haven't mentioned the name Joel Embiid other than in the context of the foul drawing. What did you, I mean, he tied for with Randall for the leading scorer, 15 free throw attempts, which is what you invoked earlier. What'd you think of him overall? Because remember, the Knicks play traditional centers almost all the time.
Yeah, and I thought Mitchell Robinson, he's always at risk of picking up fouls against Embiid. Anyone guarding Embiid is, but Robinson was plus 12. And it seemed obvious why Tom Thibodeau really wanted to match up Robinson's minutes with Embiid. And I also thought it was interesting that if he had to go to a center guarding Embiid outside of Robinson, they actually went with Jericho Sims rather than Isaiah Hartenstein. But Embiid, I thought he struggled a little bit early and then was able to get into rhythm in that first at the foul line. And then also he got that mid-ranger going as well, hitting 4-7. And particularly at the start of the third, it seemed like he came out with more energy. His first play at the start of the third was up top, hard right-handed drive past Robinson for a dunk. Then he got him on his heels, pulled up for a mid-ranger over him, and Embiid was fantastic in the third. Even hit the offensive glass as well late in the fourth. And I thought defensively, while the Knicks lit them up, that Joel did show a little more activity. Not all of it was that effective. Like, there was one play where he came from one side of the lane to the other and to contest Barrett, ended up landing on him. But I thought I did see a little bit more energy from him defending the rim, maybe just with it being a big game on Christmas, than we have seen at times this season. But even so, and even with the shooting luck, it's hard to argue with the overall defensive results from the Sixers so far this season.
For sure. And I've talked about a few times the shooting luck that they've had. And New York actually made them reasonably 12 of 32. That's, you know, a little bit under 38%. Sorry. And for Philly, I mean, there's the offensive balance. I mean, I think things are getting a little bit more back to normal, you know, Harden and Embiid playing more. And D'Anthony Melton's not going to make 5 of 7 threes every game, but usually he'll provide a little bit more defensive playmaking. I thought he did a reasonable job defensively, but he had to do that playmaking. And the what Harden does, PJ Tucker did take two shots and one free throw in this game, is I think it puts the other players in a really good chance. And I give Philly, Doc Rivers, the whole team credit for how they played in those guys' absences. But when I watched, especially the fourth quarter of this game, I'm like, oh yeah, that's how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, it really was good to see from James Harden. He was fantastic passing the ball on pick and roll. He had 13 assists, 29 points, and the 11 free throws, even though very few of those were plays where, all right, he's actually getting to the rim, really putting the defense in a compromised position. And then you mentioned Melton. I mean, that 5 of 7 from three from him, you know, he's been hitting 40%. He's taken 8 threes a game. He's averaging over 20 points since I think that number is since Maxey went out. And we probably haven't talked about him enough on this program, but I thought the biggest thing that was impressive from him was just the way he's shooting the ball, even on the move. They had a shooting set for him. They, at one point, they set a flare screen for him. They threw a pass from the weak side. So he's just been incredibly important. There was some talk maybe that Maxey could be back. He was not, of course, but that is imminent. And, you know, a lot of people have been talking too about, hey, should Melton keep starting here? Like, they've now won 8 straight. And or do they take PJ Tucker out of the starting lineup? Or maybe you make it kind of more matchup dependent as well. Those will be some interesting questions for Doc Rivers to answer. Doc generally doesn't try to rock the boat with things like this, and with
especially
Maxey,
not when the team is playing well.
Well, yeah, I guess there's two definitions of rocking the boat, right? Like what rocking the boat from like a personality standpoint. I was thinking where it's just like Tyrese Maxey has made these great strides as a scorer, and he's playing for a contract extension this year, and it just clearly would go over very poorly if he gets relegated to the bench, although we've seen the likes of Tyler Herro and Jordan Poole still get paid out of that role. So I guess we'll see what he decides and kind of see how it goes. Maybe we can get into that more at a later point. And the rest of the rotation for the Sixers, interesting, Montrezl Harrell didn't do much, but was plus 13. And he was part of those bench groups as well. And I think he benefited indirectly from New York not being able to guard the pick and pop with Niang. And so the fact that he's kind of hanging out in the dunker spot, you know, his man wasn't really able to do anything on that pick and pop. That's the beauty of pick and pop. If you're not going to switch it, is it's really hard to get help. And they tried to bring it from the opposite side at times, but it's really difficult to do that. And let's see what, you know, Tobias Harris had a quiet game, couldn't hit a three, even though everybody else on Philly was making everything. Harden as well, like his 5 of 11 from three, when he does that, you still would love to try to make James Harden make 2-point field goals, and I'm sure that's what Tom Thibodeau's plan was, and they just couldn't execute it.
Right.
I did think Thibodeau did a nice job of not taking Quentin Grimes out of the game in the first quarter when he got two fouls, both of them guarding Harden. He ended up only having four and playing 39 minutes, so that went pretty well. Any other like players who stood out? Any other kind of coaching decisions that were interesting to you? Let me see if I.
That's about all I had from this one.
Yeah, I think D'Anthony Melton is getting better at this. You know, he still is more of a playmaker defensively, but he's been asked to be in an on-ball role. And when you saw him going up against Golden State in the playoffs and play in the last couple of years, he really wasn't able to deal with Steph Curry. Now Steph's a different animal, but I thought he was a little bit better getting over screens, pressuring the ball. I thought the Knicks did a pretty good job in the first quarter on the Embiid pick and pop. Harden actually, in Embiid's big game on Friday against the Clippers, Harden was just diving up Embiid at the foul line all game long and actually had 11 assists to Embiid alone in that game on Friday. And so I thought Mitchell Robinson showed off his mobility pretty well, and then they ended up kind of going away from that, letting Joel work more off the dribble from the top than necessarily in that pick and pop because of the mobility. And also, they did a pretty good job of getting guys over from the weak side against Philly, and I thought they could have been even more aggressive with that, but they should have done it off of PJ Tucker's man. And, you know, as much as people want to talk about Tucker not taking shots, like, teams are still guarding him enough. Like, they're not just completely mucking up the Sixers offense. Like, they've won eight straight, so it's obviously working. There are a few plays where guys came over, like Brunson tried to take a charge on Embiid off the pick and pop as well, but just couldn't get there. Embiid kind of stepped around him. So that's always just an interesting dance of how you're going to guard that Harden Embiid pick and roll, which really is more of a pick and pop. Like, he's getting the ball free throw line and further up, like not in the lane the way you would on a typical pick and roll play.
Oh, it is that time again. Wedding season. Indochino's custom suits will have you walking into a wedding looking like $1 million, feeling like $1 million, because their suits are custom made to fit you perfectly. You can get a tailored fit from the comfort of your home. You can set up your measurement profile on Indochino's website, choose customizations without even leaving the house. Indochino was the official outfitter of my wedding. I got a tux from them. All my groomsmen got custom fitted sport jackets, and I'd like to think we all look great. Order your custom suit now. Be ready for wedding season, whether it's at home or in person at a showroom New Year, which I actually recommend. That's what I did. An Indochino style guy can walk you through all of the amazing customizations that they have. The lapels, the lining, single-breasted, double-breasted. You can feel the fabrics in person. That's definitely the best way to do it, in my opinion, but you can also do it from home as well. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com. Use that familiar cap space code to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com. I-N-D-O-C-H-I-N-O. Indochino.com. Don't forget that cap space code to let them know you came from us. Renters, you ever feel like you're stuck in this loop of rent payments, just watching your money vanish into thin air? It's time to turn that rent game around and start earning some serious rewards. That's where Built Rewards comes in. Built is breaking ground as the first rewards program that hooks you up with points on your rent. Even if you're still rocking the old school rent check vibes, Built Rewards has got your back. They'll mail the check for you. It's like having a personal rent paying assistant. Every month, pay your rent and watch the Built points roll in. Use points to jet off on a dream vacation. Put your points towards a flight or hotel stay with 500 plus airlines and 700,000 plus hotels and properties. You can also use your points towards a future rent payment or towards a future down payment on a home. Pay rent hassle-free through the Built Rewards app. Your rent game just got a major upgrade. Earn points by paying rent right now when you go to joinbuilt.com/capspace. That's joinbuilt, B-I-L-T, joinbuilt.com/capspace. Don't forget that /capspace URL.
You ready to move on to Lakers Mavericks?
Yeah, and for a little while, it looked like the Lakers had maybe found a formula, but ultimately, I think it was, you knew as even as they were getting out to a lead, even as Dallas only has 43 points in the first half, that the way the Lakers were defending was fool's gold, but I don't even question the strategy. They just don't have the personnel to do it any other way.
Right. I was thinking about this when we were watching it, of if you and I had been doing a broadcast of this game, one of the things I would have brought up is that the Lakers, and to their credit, I mean, they were ahead 54-43, so 11-point lead in Dallas at halftime. But I what immediately popped in my mind is, well, Dallas is 1-7 on corner threes, and especially Dallas, and some of it was this game, like corner threes are generally pretty good, and 4-15. So if you want to count it overall, that's 5-22 on threes. And just like, well, there are teams, and Dallas is one, that they don't always regress to the mean from three in the same game. Like there was that one against Toronto where Toronto was basically just letting all their guys stay open and they just didn't make them in the whole game. But just like, well, that dam might break, but I didn't expect it to break as thoroughly as it did, where a couple of the striking stats about that third quarter. So final margin was 51-21 of that quarter. That is the largest point disparity in a single quarter in the NBA this entire season. That's not stat from John Schumann. It beat that Nets Warriors one from a couple days ago. It was also the highest scoring quarter on Christmas ever, and the highest scoring quarter in the NBA this season, because there were a couple of 50 burgers, but this was a 51.
And Christian Wood had a three go in and out at the buzzer that could have made it 54 too.
Yeah. And so it was, in some ways it's historic because there aren't as many games on Christmas and everything like that, but the highest scoring quarter of the year, the highest scoring quarter on Christmas ever, that's pretty amazing.
So tactically, I thought there was a very interesting contrast between how both coaches wanted to deal with the stars. So let's not forget, Dorian Finney-Smith is out for Dallas as well. So Dallas and the Lakers both starting very small. Lakers have Beverly and Schroeder in the backcourt, and they don't really have anyone to match up with Luka because LeBron is not being asked to do that at this point in his career. They got Thomas Bryant, but they're starting Lonnie Walker at the three, basically. So it's, you know, Beverly, Schroeder, those are the guys guarding Luka. So they just decided, particularly early in the game, they're just going to double every single time. Luka had not taken a shot as of the 7 minutes gone by in the first quarter, and which is pretty rare. He usually likes to get off early in the first quarter. So, and it was working because the Mavs were just missing absolute batting practice, check the wind threes early on. Block couldn't hit one. You know, it seems like he's the most frequent culprit when they just are wide open and can't make anything. But you just felt like that dam was going to break at some point, and maybe it was going to happen towards the end of the second. Lakers come back, restore order, and had the lead going into the third quarter. But in the end, you just can't withstand this barrage unless you're playing the Chicago Bulls in the playoffs. They ended up giving up 20 corner three attempts. And for reference there, usually the worst team in the league in giving up corner threes will give up about 10 or 11 a game. So, right. And Luka was too good. I thought, yeah, what were we going
to
say, Dane?
Well, I was just going to say, to me, one of the ways you can summarize that third quarter was, and this ties in, of course, with the first half, is that Dallas was 9 of 13 on threes, and Luka didn't even attempt one of them, despite being on the floor for everything but a defensive possession at the end of it. He had 13. The rest of the team had, I think it was 38, and 27 of those 38 were on made threes.
Yeah. So there really was not much that the Lakers could do because they couldn't defend Luka one-on-one. I mean, Luka takes a special joy in destroying Patrick Beverley, going back to that first series that they played, or actually I should say more of this, the second series that they played against the Clippers, where Beverly was just, Ty Lue had to take him off of Luka. Like, there's no way, because Beverly likes to just like pressure up into Luka's body, and so Luka can just, is so big, he can just work to a spot and then spin or just shoot like his awesome touch floater over Beverly. So they had to double team, you know, Schroeder is no better there. And I thought actually by the second half, Christian Wood started doing a good job. They really challenged him by putting two on the ball against Luka, which they didn't do against Dinwiddie in pick and roll. That clearly was a Luka-specific strategy. And Luka usually kills that, but it seemed like the plan was we're actually going to stay home on that corner shooter, at least initially. Let's leave Christian Wood open, and then let's see if Christian Wood can make the play 4-on-3. I thought he had some struggles with that in the first half, but started to find a way. I mean, he still has a couple times where he'll get tunnel vision, but he's starting to get some reps, get the read to make that next pass to the corner shooter. Or, of course, he's got enough of a skill level that you have to at least step up on him, and then he can. It's impossible to guard both the corner shooters and one more player
There was a great play with that in the fourth quarter where they doubled Luka, didn't, and then Wood got the ball about the nail. And then also full credit to Spencer Dinwiddie, who did a cut along the baseline, and Wood kept his head up, found him, easy dunk, instead of it being like a miscue or something like that. And so Wood, he's growing in that role. And I mean, the offense was very good when he was on the floor. They started with Wood at center instead of Dwight Powell, who played 15 minutes, and then JaVale, who I haven't heard of an injury, so I'm guessing that's a DNP CD.
Yeah, and Wood, 30 points, 12 of 17, plus 16. He had 4 steals and 2 blocks and 7 assists. I mean, this probably, I mean, again, granted, going against this Lakers defense, but that's probably the best overall game, all-around game of his career, to play 38 minutes while starting. So at least score one in the ledger for people who say, hey, Christian Wood should have been starting this whole time. I'm not sure I can get there yet, but and they went very hard on the minutes in this game as well. Every starter played 35 or over, and their 4 main guys played 38 or more, with Tim Hardaway also scoring 26 points. And so they played Bertans, Dwight Powell, and McKinley Wright the fourth, who is a two-way guy. I don't know if his name has ever even actually been mentioned on this program before, because they do have a lot of guys out, and they needed to get at least one more ball handler in. So for the Lakers, they're obviously just trying to survive here. LeBron had 38. This is his 7th straight 30-point game. It's starting to feel a lot like it did last year. They were playing him some at center. I think they should have gone back to Thomas Bryant more. Not that Thomas Bryant is, you know, some great rotator, and yeah, you probably have to put two on the ball and pick and roll with Thomas Bryant against Luka, because he's not a good rim protector or pick and roll defender. But I think Thomas Bryant is just a good enough offensive center that he's just better than their other options offensively. So if you're going to say, hey, we're going to outscore the other team, that, like, let's just put Thomas Bryant out there, and he's not going to be any worse defensively than just not playing a center at all. What do you think about that? Because he basically didn't play much after his first stint. I don't think he played at all after his first stint in the third.
I mean, they just don't have enough frontcourt players. So I think the theory of it from you is pretty reasonable, because I don't have a great counter to it. I mean, it's not like, oh, yeah, they can do X, Y, or Z. And remember, as much as people want to talk about the LeBron at center stuff last year, those lineups couldn't defend at all.
Yeah, and they're not going to. I mean, they have no chance of stopping anyone. Like the fact that they were even remotely decent with AD out there is actually a testament to how well he was playing this year, because they can't. Like, they just don't have the personnel. It's awful. They have no wings and they have no bigs. It's like how are you going to stop anybody, particularly this Dallas team? Anything else stick out for you Lakers wise in this one?
I mean, they had a stretch, I'm trying to remember exactly when that was, where they were shooting it, where they were shooting it a little, it wasn't the first quarter for sure, where they were shooting a little better, and you're like, oh, okay. I think that was the second, and when they started pulling out the lead, Russ hit a 3, Troy Brown hit a 3, and you're like, okay, we're going around there. But as you said, the level of players, like, I mean, and yes, they're dealing with some injuries, to be sure. The number of players that, like, if I were running an NBA team, I would be happy with having on the floor in minutes that count in regular season is not that high relative to other teams.
Yeah, we talked about how Austin Reeves is their third best player, and it seemed that way. He had 16 points on 5 of 7 in this game. And Russ, 7 of 16, only played 24 minutes. They were negative 30 in that period. Did have 17 points and 4 assists. No turnovers, amazingly. But part of the problem, again, with going small is you're not going to go small unless you have Russell Westbrook on the floor. And then the other team can just put their center on him, so they can kind of get the benefits of going big. And we saw Wood get a couple of big offensive rebounds when they actually took LeBron out and still didn't put a center on the floor at that point either. At some point, you'd think they got to go back and give Damian Jones a shot. I know he's been bad this year. I mean, maybe he's not in great great shape or something, but he at least gave the Kings something last year. You give him a chance to get back to that. And you know, they've been playing Wenyen Gabriel over him or going centerless. So it's kind of, we should probably actually talk about the news on AD to finish up on the Lakers. There's the report is pretty nebulous.
It's very murky. I was going to, yeah.
Enough so that it's basically, what did they call it exactly? Here, let me find the exact verbiage.
A stress injury is, I believe, what Woj had.
Yeah, so it's not a stress reaction or a stress fracture. It's one of the two, in theory. Although it does surprise me, because it looked like usually a stress injury is something that builds up over time. I mean, maybe he did. He just tweaked it enough to where he really noticed it or something. But it looked like something acute happened. I mean, I guess it makes sense because we couldn't really see an injury mechanism. Surely it's not. This would seem to rule out the idea that it was the result of him kind of like banging it in the air against Jokic. So supposedly he's now pain-free. He's going to try to ramp up a little bit. Like, he hasn't been wearing a walking boot or anything either, which is kind of weird. So, I mean, it seems like, you know, maybe there's some optimism, you know, 2-3 weeks. I think sometimes when they come out with these reports, it's almost to maybe even just motivate your own team. It's just like, if you know he's out for the year and things are hopeless, or you know he's out for 6 weeks and things are hopeless, then it's like, hey, why try? But you feel like, hey, you know, if we play hard for these next 2-3 weeks, maybe we could pull a few victories out of our ass. And even though we know that it's not sustainable, this kind of effort all season, to just stay afloat, because they desperately need to stay afloat here.
What it feels to me sort of along those lines is, I know it was Carol, Matt Damon's character on 30 Rock, where he's a pilot and they keep on saying that it's 15 minutes. And so because they know 15 minutes is the amount of time that people won't get pissed off, but then also might not necessarily think about it. So it's like, oh, we'll find out more in 2 weeks. But they didn't say, like, it didn't seem anything clear, like, this is what's wrong, this is how the time. Now, it's good that the pain has subsided, which is something that I think Woj and Dave McMenamin both had. That's definitely a positive. But what caused the pain, how this actually resolves is a lingering question, and one that, as the Lakers are now, I believe they're now 13-19, one that will
13-20
after losing the game, that will define the rest of their season.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically just they're back to the exact same team that they had most of last year, where, okay, you play small, but you don't really shoot it enough to run up the score against the other team. And if you're playing small, you're also at a real deficit defensively. And playing small, you don't have, it's not like you have like guys with like a bunch of length and athleticism on the perimeter either. I mean, it's just a bad team. And LeBron, I think, is going to continue to put up numbers. And worth noting, even now, he was +2 in his 34 minutes, but I don't think they're going to play him more than 34 minutes. He's had his own issues this season, and he turns 38th on December 30th.
Well, and also, like, how much do you want to push him during these where you're turning what would be like a sure loss into a possible, maybe even a likely loss, versus keeping the powder a little bit more dry? And some of that challenge is like the Lakers right now, they've lost 4 straight. LeBron has had, as you said, like, I think he's had 30 or close to 30 in basically all of these games when Davis has been out. But they've won, so Davis got hurt against the Nuggets in a game they won. They've won once since then, and that was by 2 points at home against the Wizards. So are you putting miles on LeBron in games that you increase your chances, but are, you know, those aren't necessarily the most useful? And it's hard. And it's, I mean, it's the idea, Darvin Ham and Rob Pelinka and LeBron James, it's like your best chance to win games, but it's a tightrope. And I hope that, because, you know, that LeBron has enough to go, but I have this worry that it's just going to be like, he's going to be working really hard now physically, and he and I are basically the same age, so I think about this stuff a lot, and be like, then he tries to kick it in because AD's back, and it's like, oh, if we have a push now, we have a chance to make playoffs, and then something happens there.
Quickly for the Mavs, they had a ton of absences. That's why the starters had to play so many minutes. Kemba Walker had played 4 straight games. He had a huge game, getting the game where they rested everybody to overtime and looked great against the Cavs, but he's now missed 2 straight due to left knee injury recovery. Of course, Kleba is out as well for them. Josh Green still hasn't come back from...
It's an elbow issue. I believe it's right, an elbow strain.
I remember that I thought he was supposed to be back, but we haven't heard anything about that. Yeah, I thought maybe he'd gotten a new injury, but no, it's still that right elbow sprain. He's been out since December 9th. And Frank Ntilikina, who is, I think, health has actually been an underrated part of his struggles. He's been out for a while with the sore left knee also, which is why they had to play McKinley Wright with those two guys out. And Finney Smith is still out with that adductor issue in addition to Kleba. So that was at least three guys who would normally be in their rotation who are out. But the brilliance of Luka, who, by the way, just 32 points, 9 assists. And they tried to go at him in pick and roll in the fourth when LeBron had 12 points in the first 4 minutes of the fourth. But they couldn't get a stop because the Mavs were raining threes and were 10 to 20 in corner threes in the end. And Wood was getting a bunch of dunks around the rim. So it was tough times for the Lakers right now. Mavs moved to 18 and 16. They've kind of been somewhat similar to the Warriors in that they're now 13 and 5 at home.
Are you waking up with a ton of back pain or shoulder pain or neck pain? The number one reason probably to consider is your mattress. Maybe it's time for a new mattress. And I highly recommend that you check out Helix Sleep, which you can do risk-free with their 100-night trial and a 10 to 15-year warranty, depending on the model. And they have 20 unique mattresses, the award-winning Lux, the Ultra Premium Elite Collections. They have Helix Plus, which is designed for big and tall sleepers. Helix Kids, endorsed by child sleep experts. You can take their 2-minute sleep quiz. That's what my wife and I did over 10 years ago now. We still have a number of Helix Sleep mattresses that we've gotten over the years, and we are extremely satisfied with them even now, 10 years later. You might be like, I kind of want to try it out beforehand. Going to the store is not really going to give you any information. You're going to be like, lay down, like, oh, do I take off my shoes? Maybe I should leave my shoes on, but then I got to have my feet hanging off the mattress because I can't leave my shoes on and sleep normally on this mattress. And then you're going to feel awkward laying there after about 30 seconds. Like, you can't determine anything in 30 seconds. So you're going to have to take it home, and you might as well just get it delivered straight to your door and utilize that 100-night trial. And there's never been a better time to use Helix because they are offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. You can go to helixsleep.com/capspace. Easy to remember, /capspace. We talk about it all the time here on the program. That's helixsleep.com/capspace. This is their best offer yet. It won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. So I will be honest, I tend to pack on the pounds a little bit during the winter, holiday season, not getting outside as much. So in springtime, I try to eat healthier, and I'm really excited to try Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Each meal is fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. This is going to be fantastic for me during the playoffs, when a lot of times I feel like I don't have time to eat healthy, and now I can choose from a number of their delicious but healthy options. I like to go keto. On occasion, they have that. They have vegan and veggie options as well. Here's what they've got for their keto weekly menu this week. Sun-dried tomato chicken with zucchini noodles. Spicy poblano beef bowl with roasted broccoli. Chicken piccata with cauliflower mash and broccoli. Or if you want to go their chef's choice weekly menu, jalapeno lime cheddar chicken. That sounds fantastic. Greek lemon chicken with roasted potatoes. This all sounds really, really good. Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, cleaning up, heat, and savor the good stuff. And they're also celebrating Earth Day all month long as well. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/dunked50, special code for this one. That's factormeals.com/dunked50, and use the code dunked50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. That's code DUNKED50 at factormeals.com/DUNKED50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All right, Danny is now on a red eye to the East Coast as we record this, which means get a chance to bring in Dan Feldman to talk about the last 3 games. Dan, enjoying that West Coast life here at 10:57 p.m. instead of 1:57 a.m. on the East Coast.
Yeah, I think my body is somewhere in between. It's probably about 12:30 a.m. for me right now.
Yeah, well, let's get right to it here. And the game of the day was the last one, a 128-125 Denver Nuggets victory in overtime, despite the fact that the Phoenix Suns controlled this one throughout, even in the absence of Devin Booker. So We'll talk some about the end of the game, which was quite the shit show. But just from the overall meat of the game, what were some of your big takeaways?
I mean, Nikola Jokic is incredible. His control over the game is just something to behold. His scoring, his passing, the defense is not elite by any means, but he is not the problem. Well, I'm sure we'll get into the Nuggets defensive problems. Jokic had a part in them, but he is not the problem. I mean, his offensive control, his touch with the ball. I mean, this was, he's not going to win MVP on one game if he wins it for a third straight year, but on this date to put up 41, 15 and 15, that's going to get a lot of attention as it deserves.
Yeah. I was thinking about the idea of the most skilled player in NBA history, and you throw Steph Curry out there. Obviously people talk about Kyrie Irving, Larry Bird would probably have to be in that conversation. MJ would probably have to be in that conversation, but Jokic is in there too. I mean, he doesn't do all the crazy dribbling stuff, but considering his size, he's an outstanding dribbler. You never see him like get his pocket picked when he's pushing it up full court or anything like that. One of the best passers ever. And just the shot making, like the one that he hit in the overtime where he looks at the clock at the other end, there's 3 seconds left, isolated against a guard, Chris Paul, gets past Chris Paul, picks his ball up at the 3-point line, takes 2 steps, right hand, right foot floater from 17, and it's just cash. Like he's shooting almost 60% from mid-range, not to even mention floater range, and he's one of the best finishers in the league at the rim as well, despite not being able to jump over a phone book because of his incredible touch. And I mean, the other thing I thought was amazing was just when they get him the ball at the elbow and they run the split cut actions, like, you know, the Warriors popularized that for 3-pointers. They'll just have 2 guys who aren't even necessarily shooters just interact with each other. One of them will cut back door. And if there's any kind of a size advantage, Jokic is going to find them. And I mean, to me, the only blemish on his game wasn't necessarily caused by him. It's that they went away from him a little bit too much down the end, although they managed to pull it out anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's a balancing act. It wasn't that long ago. It's easy to forget, but it wasn't that long ago where a big storyline with Jokic was, is he aggressive enough offensively? Is he deferring too much? Now, he's mostly gotten past that, but I can see how it's possible to get away from him a little bit in a way that it shouldn't be for a scorer of his caliber, but it's so much progress from where he was.
It seems like Jamal Murray had it going a little bit. He had 12 points in the fourth, hit 3 3-pointers in pretty quick succession. And maybe there was a feeling that they just wanted to get back to the old Jamal Murray and let him cook a little bit to feel that again. And I thought he maybe was feeling it a little bit too much with some of that shot selection. Like he took a 3 on a fast break down 1 where they had a numbers advantage. And he probably could have got in for a layup. There wasn't really a rim protector pack under a minute to go, and took a couple of pretty difficult fadeaways as well. But I understand why they did that, but I also don't think it was their best offense to win this basketball game. But hey, it all worked out anyway.
Yeah, that 3 late. I mean, look, Jamal Murray, it was an interesting mix of, and you can see somebody who's getting back from injury, times where it just doesn't seem like he has quite the comfort level of when to be aggressive, when not, as much as he used to, at least. And I think that was more noticeable early. There were times he was too tentative. There were times, you know, he went up for that big dunk. He didn't convert that, but you can see him just trying to be aggressive. And it didn't seem to be coming naturally until late. That 3 you're talking about late. So there were 2 he made shortly before that. I can't remember if they were on back-to-back possessions or in quick succession. I think on 1, he gnashed and went under the basket and came back out and then hit a 3. And then another one, I believe, was off a Jokic screen. But the one you're talking about that he missed, I thought maybe he was too open. It seemed like he had an extra beat where he kind of hesitated. Maybe Murray pre-injury doesn't hesitate, and that just lets it fly and he makes it.
Yeah, you could see too, Klay Thompson's been going through this as well. Guys who really like can reach that incandescent level of hotness the way that Klay can and that we've seen from Jamal Murray, like in the bubble, for example, they want to feel that again so badly, and it can lead to them maybe hunting some shots a little bit. But so my next takeaway though, in terms of big themes, we could talk more about the end later, is, you know, CP, he did have 16 assists in this game. Still, to me, I don't know if you agree, just does not look anywhere close athletically to the guy that he was at his best last season.
100% agree. He's just not as aggressive. You know, there were opportunities to go for a shot. You know, we haven't even said, we should just say for posterity, Devin Booker got hurt early. That groin injury again, played only 4 minutes. And so other players, stuff that was not Chris Paul. He kept the ball moving. He was, 16 assists, zero turnovers, right? I mean, it's what Chris Paul does. There were times late where it seemed like he was a little more aggressive and didn't quite have the rhythm because he hadn't been doing that. And the big thing I wonder, and I really don't have a clue, is he doing this because it's a long season and he's in his late 30s and what's the point of being aggressive offensively until the playoffs? Or does he just not have that gear anymore? I wish I had a better sense of that because there's all the difference in the world between those two scenarios.
I thought last year the usage rate did go down, but there'd be times in the fourth quarter when he would take over and you could tell that he had it. And that has been lacking so far this year. And, even extended to the free throw line where he was a 5 out of 10, but 6 of 17 overall. He had been shooting the three more after coming back from the quote unquote heel injury that he had to miss a month. But he wasn't really aggressive from three in this game, 0 for 3. But I thought just getting to his spot, you mentioned whether it's a confidence issue or just doesn't feel comfortable or doesn't have the same explosion. You know, he looks like he's always about to fall over. Like, you never see him go to a dead sprint pushing the ball up, which hurt them when they couldn't get a 2-for-1 in overtime at the end. But his ability to just kind of stop and pop and quickly get his shot off, seems like he's rushing that. He got a shot blocked by Michael Porter Jr. Like, he used to, even as recently as last year, like, he was killing, the likes of like Larry Nance, a good switch defender in the playoffs in isolation when they were switched. And, when Michael Porter Jr. is not Larry Nance, and he was able to block CP. So it just looked like he would get into a lot of situations where he just wasn't sure if he could get his shot off. Sometimes he would shoot it and get stuck or get blocked, have to throw a bailout pass to the corner where Shamet got a three in the overtime. So, and he had to play 41 minutes. They had to run a lot through him, of course, in this game. And I didn't think that he wasn't like unaggressive. It was just when he was aggressive, he just wasn't able to get the separation.
So there was a play late where the Suns ran a 1-5 pick and roll. And I believe it was against drop coverage. And Paul ended up just being able to walk into a fairly open mid-range jumper in crunch time. It's the last minute of the fourth quarter. And he missed it. And part of me wonders, the Suns had all that success last year in crunch time. That was such a big thing. And crunch time it's a small sample. And did we overreact to, Chris Paul and Devin Booker to an extent, but especially Chris Paul just happening to be super hot in crunch time, where even if we know Chris Paul is good at those types of plays and good in those situations, I'm just talking about one single shot. But maybe we overreacted last year, and this year it's a little bit of regression to the mean, and he's still somewhere in between those two things. I don't know. I really don't have a great read on what Chris Paul is capable of. I think we see what he's doing, but what he's capable of, is it far less than last year? I don't know.
Yeah, that's what makes the current era that we're in a little frustrating to analyze, is that the playoffs are what matter, but he was at least dominating down the end of regular season games last year. And it just, the way that jumper looked, like, I remember the one you're talking about, right elbow, exactly the spot. But he looked like he wasn't as in control as he normally is. Like, he could get to a spot, rise up. It's almost like he felt like he had to go faster. He felt like he had to get it off more quickly because he wasn't getting the same rise on it. And, obviously he missed that one. It looked like he was actually like trying to jump higher than he would normally. So I hope that he can get back to it. I will say he looks, he's never been like the sveltest of body, but I do think he looks a little bit heavier maybe after that layoff. And so if he can cut up a little bit, maybe some of that athleticism will return by the end of the season. Yeah, Booker gave it a go. He'd missed a few with this nebulous groin soreness. A side was not given, and he had to leave again. That's after missing time with the hamstring. And as the Suns are now dropped to 19-15, nobody's doing anything in the West right now, but we'll have to see how long he's going to miss, because you never like it when you come back and re-injure the same thing. And obviously he wanted to play on Christmas. At least I like that guys like do try to play hard on Christmas. Like, it does seem like these games matter maybe more than your average regular season game. What do you think of DeAndre Ayton's game tonight?
He made a lot of mid-range shots. I see a lot of areas for concern. There's a play early, right? You talk about the effort guys give on Christmas. This is why it stood out to me early, where he dropped a pass, which happens, And he's just kind of like messing around, not getting back on defense, or multiple times he can get back on defense, was maybe out of position. It's just, I appreciate that mid-range shot making. It's nice that you have somebody so athletic, so big, who has that element when your star scorer goes down, or, you know, there are going to be times when Booker's on the bench, right? It's helpful to have that element and all the normal things Ayton does. But I don't see him as a trustworthy player. He has too many mistakes, defensive breakdowns. I see all the talent, and I see the upside, and on a lot of teams, I'd want him. If I'm on a championship contender, I worry about him.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, there are many, even Richard Jefferson said on the broadcast, like, oh, well, he's an obvious, you know, that he should have gotten paid. And like, yeah, he should have gotten paid. Should he have just been a no-brainer max contract? Like, I would disagree on that. I think they used the system the way they should have. But, and again, you know, this is, for longtime listeners of this show, this is no surprise, but in this game, when you've got Devin Booker out, I thought Ayton, and again, Joel Embiid is Joel Embiid, right? We saw this in the first game of the day, and I don't expect Ayton to be Joel Embiid, but I would like DeAndre Ayton to be able to up his usage a little bit more in pick and roll with the face of the basket game that involves something other than just shooting a jumper the moment he gets it. And on like those short roll pick and rolls, you know, they didn't really seem to be able to get him those deep seals out of pick and roll. You know, I thought Jokic did a good job battling with him and denying him position. That's one thing that Jokic is pretty good at. But in theory, DeAndre Ayton should have the quickness advantage on Jokic. And so to get the ball at the foul line coming downhill with a little bit of separation, but he can't, you know, pump fake and drive. Like, that's not really something that he has in his game. He can't really put it on the floor. He had 6 turnovers in this one as well. So a few times where he really, like, Ayton is a willing passer when the pass is obvious. But also once he's like on the move, when he's swarmed, it gets a little bit more difficult for him. So some of those 6 turnovers were of that ilk. He also missed a key free throw late that could have put the game away instead, or at least put him up 3 instead of 2. And then Murray got the tying dunk after that. So I do think Ayton still does about as good of a job as you can guarding Jokic individually, even as crazy as it is to say with Jokic's ridiculous stats. But and I think he makes it at least somewhat hard for him on post-ups, which, you know, maybe there's 10 guys in the league, maybe fewer than that, who can do that. But, you know, Jokic is still so skilled, it doesn't matter if you get him the ball on the move. He doesn't have to just post up one-on-one. So he does add value that way. You know, hasn't really been impressive as a rim protector to me this season or in this game, but he's stuck to Jokic. So, yeah, I think it's we were hoping, again, to see more from DeAndre Ayton. And it seems like he really has kind of plateaued the last season and a half or so.
Yeah. You brought up the contract. I was always so curious of if the Suns made a mistake, just in terms of if it's likely enough he's going to get paid in the long run anyway. If you keep him happy, will that make him more engaged? Will that make him work harder? Or are you better off from that mental standpoint having him going after the contract? And now he has the contract. And we're just seeing a lot of the same things. I don't know if it would have made a difference or not, either approach. Like, plateau is – I don't know if that's completely fair. I mean, some of the mid-range jumping – or jumpers, you know, he's making, you know, that's – I think there are additions in his game. But the area it needs to come in is sharpening his defense, avoiding some of these mistakes rather than expanding his game.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. I mean, I felt – I had hoped that this year – that they could give DeAndre Ayton more of the ball to create some plays, and it just doesn't appear he's capable of that. But, you know, it was a banner game for Suns shooting guards off the bench. Landry Shamet played 39 minutes. That's, I'm guessing, pretty close to a Suns high, and 31 points almost certainly, I would guess, is a, maybe might even be a career high, but I'm guessing for sure a Suns high. And the most impressive number to me is just getting up 17 three-point attempts. 7 of 17, 10 of 20 from the field overall. And so 31 points for him plus 3. He came in, even was doing a little bit of backup point guard for them as well with Campaign, who's also out right now. I mean, the Suns are very, very shorthanded. Remember, Cam Johnson's out too for them. So I thought that was really good. Like, to add that movement shooting element, they really didn't have much else in terms of creation offensively. And they ran a lot of plays for him, and he delivered.
He also scored 31 against the Wizards last week. So,
okay.
tied as high within the week. Excuse me. yeah. Shamet did a great job of taking advantage of his quick release. I, you know, the Nuggets defense fell asleep a few times. Jamal Murray got eaten up on some screens as Shamet came off and couldn't stick with him. And it doesn't take much space. He gets those shots up. You know, sometimes you watch him do this and you wonder why he isn't a more effective offensive player more often.
Yeah, and I never, you know, his jumper kind of waxes and wanes. Like, it is a pretty flat shot. Mm-hmm. But I mean, my bigger concern with that signing wasn't the regular season. It was just that, or I should say the trade for him and then signing. It was just that the defensive concerns about him in the playoffs. And then Damian Lee is continuing a banner season. Like, where would the Suns be without him in the absence of Cam Johnson? He was a further 4 of 5 from three. And it was funny. He's shooting it incredibly well. He's got to be shooting like 48%, I think, this year. So, and the big problem with him with the Warriors down the end of last year was he couldn't make shots. So yeah, he's been fantastic for them, giving them just some movement in the half court as well. And, you know, executing the system defensively.
I mean, with those two guys, the Suns made 49% of their threes, 17 of 35. I thought the Nuggets outplayed Phoenix in this game.
Not even close.
And I thought that even when the Suns were up comfortably, I couldn't figure out why the Suns were up other than they just hit a lot of their threes. Lee and Shamet did a good job of moving to create good looks, but to combine to, you know, make 11 of 22, that's over their heads. And you know, the rest of the team was shooting pretty hot. And that's why they were in it.
Yeah. And for Denver's part, I mean, Aaron Gordon, 7 of his 11 field goals made were dunks. And the only
marks. Including. I was wondering how long we were going to go. And I got to diverge. We got to talk about Aaron Gordon's dunk.
Yeah, at the end, I mean, that was one of the best dunks ever on Christmas. And the most hilarious part of it to me was, I mean, if you haven't seen it yet, just go and look at the highlight of his dunk on Landry Shamet. Pretty dumb decision, actually, probably to go for that in that you situation.
So? I see, you're not alone in thinking that, and I don't. Well, I mean, Aaron Gordon has the ball. What do you want Aaron Gordon to do?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they're up one. Well, no, was there a differential there? I think there was. I think there was like a three or four second differential. Mm-hmm. So I think they should have just run the time down at that point. And, instead he went in transition for one of the most ridiculous 2 foot dunks that I've seen. Landry Shamet is set up to take a charge. I'd say maybe what, like 3 feet outside the restricted area. And Gordon just takes off at 2 feet, one hand, and just goes right through Shamet. Charge is called. And then they go to this review, which is, you know, same thing with the goaltending rule at the end, where it's like, oh, well, we got a review to check if he's in the restricted area. And this rule doesn't make any sense, Dan, to me, like the trigger, but then you can overturn it if it's not if he's not in legal guarding position with something that has nothing to do with the restricted area, but you can only check if you think he might have been in the restricted area. That doesn't make any sense, right?
Yeah, I don't think he was that far in front of the restricted area if you're just going by like the back of his heel, especially because he's also, well, it's close to that, you know, also because he's maybe moving back on it, that gets him even closer to the restricted area. For me, I don't know. I just want the correct calls to be called and quickly, however we need to do to go about that. And, well, they got it correct in the end, I think.
Yeah, he was moving his torso subtly to the left and
going up a little bit too.
Yeah. So the restricted area needs to be bigger if you can get dunked on the ground on a charge and it's called a charge. Like it just, the restricted area came into being 20 years ago now. Athletes are better. Just expand it. There's no reason to have guys taking a charge in that situation when someone's going up for a dunk. But, yeah, they got the, but yeah, so they were.
And expanded even more in games Aaron Gordon is playing.
yeah, it's true. I mean,
He was flying all over the place. I mean, obviously he had this dunk, but I thought just such a great game of activity, aggressiveness. He had 28 points, 13 rebounds. He's not like the most sound defender, but he applied his athleticism so well on both ends of the court, crashing the glass, 7 offensive rebounds, going back up. What did you say? 7 of the 11 makes were dunks? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, he had his legs tonight.
Yeah, now on the season, Aaron Gordon coming in was 67% true shooting, which would be a career high by over 7%. And it went up tonight. And yeah, he also 8.7% offensive rebound. That is a career high by almost 3%. So he's just been working. using his physicality, playing off of Jokic, receiving passes. I've really enjoyed his season. And you know, we were concerned about the lack of spacing. He's taking the occasional three and making 38%. I think that's still not something that teams are concerned about, but he's active enough offensively that it kind of doesn't matter. And Jokic can operate from the elbows as well, and also just make passes to him in such tight spaces that, and he has got that vertical spacing. So yeah, he's been fantastic so far this season. Maybe hasn't had the exact same level of defensive impact that he's had in the past. However, the Nuggets are the number one clutch defense in the NBA, despite being very low overall. As you noted earlier, maybe some luck involved there, but worth noting that that's been a part of why they've been able to be successful. And I thought their defense was really good. Like KCP had a couple of big steals and pressures on Landry Shamet, and then he got Ayton from behind for a steal. So they did raise their intensity down the end.
Yeah, I mean, not down the end, but I thought Bruce Brown had his moments. Like, this is a team that maybe this is why they're good in the clutch, or maybe I'm just looking for a reason to explain something that's just a small sample. But I feel like they can dial it up at times. A lot of their defensive problems are inattentiveness over the course of a game. But when they lock in, I'm not saying it's great, but it does seem a lot better.
Another big point for me is the Nuggets bench struggling. They're up 15 early, and they kind of fall apart. The Phoenix leads by 6 at halftime. Bones Highland, 1 of 6, 0 of 5 from 3, 2 turnovers. His defense hasn't been good. He was negative 13 in 14 minutes. They were very judicious with the bench minutes, with no Vlatko Chanchar either, who's been, I didn't see anything about him being hurt, but he's been in the rotation at times recently. Michael Porter Jr., though, kind of an afterthought tonight.
Yeah, 3 for 11, 0 for 5 on threes, finished with 7 points. Did not really make much of an impact. At one point during the game, I said, I wonder how Michael Porter Jr. is doing, because I have not noticed him.
Yeah, he played 35 minutes and
quietly.
Yeah, he just did not really feature at all, and they're not paying him a max contract. He probably should have featured more, honestly, in our worst contracts, and because he was out, and so maybe wasn't top of mind for me. And he'd been hitting shots early, but other than, you know, he doesn't seem to have the same explosiveness. But if you're not really running plays for him and getting him shots within the flow of the offense, a lot of his value is decreased. Though I thought his defense was fine tonight. But that obviously is something to watch for this Denver team. And how are you feeling about the Nuggets here? We'll talk a little bit about the end of the game, but overall this season, are you buying, because we haven't talked about this, are you buying them as, you know, real contenders for the West or to win the championship?
Yeah, I tend to have a wider pool of contenders than most people do. I think the Nuggets have a chance. They're first in the West. Jokic is awesome. We've seen him step up in the playoffs year after year. If there were any way for their bench not to bleed the lead quite as much, he'd feel a lot better. I mean, tonight it was with Jokic on. He played 44 minutes. The Nuggets were plus 11. And then in the other 9 minutes, that makes them minus 8. And it's like that over and over and over. Bones Highland was kind of a Michael Porter Jr. version of off the bench. He was 1 for 6 for 3 points, and worse defense. You know, I would not say it was just okay like Porter's was. And if it were just the starters, I'd feel a lot better about the Nuggets. And you get in the playoffs, obviously rotations shrink. That's probably to their advantage, but probably don't shrink enough.
So just a few plays I wanted to talk about that I thought were interesting from the end. We didn't necessarily have to go through possession by possession here, because we've talked a lot about this game already, but and about some of the themes at the end. Jamal Murray got the tying dunk on a handoff after Ayton missed 1 out of 2 free throws that could have increased it to 3. They had, I think, about 12 seconds left. And that play, I thought it was interesting. We're starting to see really an awareness by the team that's up 2 to not give up a 3. Like, you don't want to allow yourself to lose the game. And so it seems like maybe we're starting to get a little bit of game theory now where teams are adjusting. Jamal Murray goes right down the lane. Nobody from the weak side even thinks about helping. Obviously, Ayton wasn't going to, because he would have been helping off of Jokic, but they didn't want to help because there were guys available on the weak side. And you know, Murray did get a blow by on Bridges, but I thought it's interesting that just it seemed like everyone was so worried about not giving up the 3 that they just gave up the tying dunk. And obviously, Denver won it in overtime.
I wanted to get your opinion more on that play, because I wasn't really sure what to think. Chris Paul, I thought, had a chance to tag Murray rolling down the or I guess not tag, but maybe help on Murray just a little rolling down the lane without leaving somebody open from three. And then Torrey Craig was near the basket. Aaron Gordon was in the dunker spot, also a chance to help. But I'm not sure if they should have. I'm not sure if either one of them rotating over was going to leave somebody too open. Obviously, you don't want to give up the dunk.
It wouldn't have been a higher percentage shot than – I mean, I know the math on it is you don't want to go down one. Although, keep in mind, whether they tie it or you go down one, you still have a chance to come back in this scenario on the other end. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's particularly because I would say Phoenix is kind of the underdog in this game that I might have been a little bit more aggressive saying, all right, Denver, you want to take a three and try to beat us now when you're at home and we're the underdog and you're playing well. And Nikola Jokic is in the midst of a ridiculous game and he's plus 12 and we know he's going to be out there for the whole overtime. Yeah, I think I would have tried to take away the two a little bit more in that specific situation. Other times the math changed a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, especially Torrey Craig and Aaron Gordon, like that's not even helping off a three. That's just, right. That's just helping off somebody who's positioned to maybe just dunk it. If you make Murray not dunk, I mean, I don't know if you can assume that with it, where everything Murray is, that he's going to drive down and dunk like that. I don't know. I really don't know what the right defensive play there was.
Well, the other thing too is just it was such a blow by that it's tough if you're outside the lane and someone gives up a blow by from the 3-point line. Like it's tough to get over there.
Yeah.
After that, then they actually called the slip the screen foul where I think it was KCP tried to go under. They ran like a guard screen and it was the same call. This was actually in the league's points of education video, their most recent one where Klay Thompson did the same thing, tried to slip the screen. The defender on the ball handler tries to go under and Klay just ran him over against the Cavs and Steph got a wide open three. This time the referees made the call. That's tough though, because you think that's an illegal screen. I guess you have to get out of the guy's way if you're that slip man, but you're trying to get out of there to create the space to get open. So that was a good play by KCP drawing that foul. But then they inbound it to Jamal Murray in the backcourt, 4.7 left out of timeouts. And it just, you know, there's no play really being run. Jokic, maybe it's tough to get it to him in that situation, you know, dribbling the ball up necessarily against Ayton, but they could at least have hit, like Murray and Jokic could have interacted with one another. I thought there was time for that. And instead, Murray one-on-one against Bridges just got his jumper blocked.
Yeah, I did not think that was a great possession by the Nuggets at the end. One of the tough things that I think gets underestimated is when you're shooting that late, Bridges could perfectly time that up because he knows what time Murray has to release it by. It's right at the buzzer, and that makes it easier to block.
In the overtime, one thing that stuck out to me, the Suns have a chance to bring it up for the 2-for-1 and down one. This is right before the Gordon dunk. And Chris Paul can't really push it up, but then he also, and this is, I think, after Jokic missed a post-up fadeaway, had to tell DeAndre Ayton the play. Like, it took time for Chris Paul to, like, point him into position, get him to set the screen, and then they brought Shamet off a screen from the weak side. Shamet could have hit a three that would have given him the lead, but missed it. And then he had another one that could have tied it late after Gordon and Murray both hit one out of two free throws. That was disappointing that DeAndre Ayton, like, not knowing the play was part of why they didn't get that 2-for-1 in the end. Although then Gordon went for the dunk anyway and kind of erased the mistake. Anything else on this one? I think I'm pretty much.
Note I had was Mikal Bridges, I thought, did an adequate job of, you know, he's got to play a little bigger this year with Jay Crowder out, spending more time matching up with somebody like Eric Gordon, where he's at a physical disadvantage. And, you know, I just thought he did an adequate job of battling through that. Not the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, there was one time Aaron Gordon tried to post him up and Bridges blocked a shot. Bridges actually had four block shots in this game. And I thought when he did get the ball at the 3-point line, he was a little bit more aggressive. Still only got up 5 threes in 40 minutes. But it's kind of awkward because he has that long looping motion. But he's able to shoot on the move a little bit more in this game. Went 2-for-5.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening, smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
Let's turn now to what we thought was the main event before this day began, and that was Boston in Milwaukee. Chris Middleton was not able to make it back. Fifth consecutive game that he was out with this knee soreness. So it is not the same knee that he suffered the MCL injury in last postseason. I thought it was notable at the start of the second quarter. Mike Budenholzer said, yeah, you know, they're shooting really well. I think Boston was 6-10 from three in the first. Like, yeah, you know, we really hope the percentages catch up to us. That didn't happen.
The Celtics are a great shooting team and shot especially great. I watch a lot of this through the prism of how would this translate to a playoff series between these teams? Because that's what we're all hoping for, maybe to a degree expecting. And, you know, the Celtics are not going to make 49% of their three-pointers every game. But this is a great shooting team. Like, you can't just wish it away and think it's going to, you know, be even average. They're going to be above average. The question is going to be how much above average.
Yeah, obviously Jason Tatum was the start of that, and he wasn't really that reliant on the three-pointer. Certainly his teammates making shots was helpful, but he was 14-22 and also 10-10 from the foul line. And I think the biggest difference to me in Tatum's game this season is his scoring from two-point range, and he didn't do it as much at the rim in this one, but for him to go 11-15 from two-point range against this Bucks defense, which is where two-pointers go to die, that was incredibly impressive for me to put up 41 points against this team.
I thought Tatum and Jaylen Brown, to a degree too, were just so unbothered by the Bucks' smaller wings. Pat Connaughton, who's a good defender, it just seemed like they just shot right over him, those two-point jumpers. Grayson Allen got picked on a lot. Wes Matthews.
Oh, yeah.
It was just, you know, this is why I wonder if Middleton being healthy would make a difference. Middleton's a good defender, but he's also just a little bit taller. And maybe that's just what you need. Tatum's got that nice high release. It's going to be tough regardless. Tatum's a great player. But I do feel like that's where they especially miss Middleton.
Yeah. And also the Milwaukee Bucks are going to be in a drop coverage. And we've seen Jason Tatum when he has struggled. It's been, and I think he's gotten better at it this year, but it was against good switching defenses, against the Warriors in the finals when he couldn't beat the likes of Draymond Green and Kevon Looney. And the Bucks have Defensive Player of the Year candidate Brooke Lopez and Defensive Player of the Year candidate Giannis Antetokounmpo both out there. But since they have those guys, they're almost invariably, we saw it maybe a little bit when they had PJ Tucker back in 21 where they switched more, but largely they just stick to that drop cover. I think Jason Tatum, it's just very easy for him. You know, you remember he had that crazy 46 point game in game six last year too. It's just very easy for him to get comfortable. You know, sometimes he'll be going against a Drew Holiday or something, but they could set a guard screen to get him the matchup that he wants. I don't think he's worried about Pat Connaughton, particularly when he can just come off a screen and get the ball on the move, and he's got all that great spacing. The Bucks really had no answers for him. They put up a .139 in this game against Milwaukee.
How are you feeling about Brooke Lopez as a defender right now? I mean, I thought he was just so neutralized by the Celtics going five out, and he just did not have that level of impact. And a lot of what Brooke Lopez does, taking away the rim, I think the theory is, and the Celtics really actualized it today, is eventually you're going to run into a team, and it's going to be more likely deeper in the playoffs, that's just really good at making jumpers, and you're not going to bother them in the same way. And then on top of that, I thought when Robert Williams came in, his vertical spacing gave Brooke Lopez some problems at times. This was, I did not think, a very good defensive game from Brooke Lopez, and maybe in a way that worries me a little bit.
Yeah, 18-20 at the rim for Boston and 9-17 from floater range, and then got to the foul line for 25 attempts as well. They did shut off the offensive glass. Boston's not really an offensive rebounding team. So, yeah, I didn't think it was Brooke Lopez's best game defensively, but there have been other games, and particularly in the playoffs last year, where he and Giannis totally walling off the rim did cause problems for this team. So I'm not going to say that the strategy is not going to work against them, but I do think Boston is better offensively this year than they were last year. And basically everyone on this team has gotten better, you know, unless Al Horford ends up with some issues. I think also just adding Malcolm Brogdon as well and Marcus Smart, like those two guys, just the way that they get penetration or even that they can attack some of the weaker links, whether that's Grayson Allen, who anytime Smart or Brogdon had the ball in any kind of a scramble situation, they started going after Grayson Allen, particularly when those rim protectors aren't quite in position. So that was effective. Like Smart only had two field goals, but both of them were drives. And then he also had eight assists. It was a pretty good passing game on his drives. So, yeah, I mean, everything was really working for them. They went with, interestingly, Derek White rather than Grant Williams. Like, they've gotten a little bit smaller under Joe Mazzulla, but I think that paid off as well. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we'll see what happens when these guys get to Milwaukee and who has home court and all that. And once Middleton comes back, he's been really bad this year. Hopefully he can get back. I thought the other thing, though, that would maybe give me a little bit of concern, and maybe Chris Middleton can help with this, but maybe not. Giannis just pretty much ineffective around the basket offensively tonight.
Yeah, I guess. So one thing I should say in terms of Tatum and to a lesser degree Brown, when I said maybe Middleton would help, so could Giannis. If this game mattered more, I think Giannis would spend some time guarding Jason Tatum more than he did, and that could make a difference. And I think the same thing is true offensively. I think for the Bucks to beat the Celtics, most likely, there are some other routes to it, but most likely, Giannis is just going to have to will the Bucks to victory, and he's capable of that. I don't think he was in that type of attack mode today. I don't think he was looking to take on that burden. But in the playoffs, like, we've seen him do that. He is capable. You know, he made some of those mid-range jumpers. Ideally, he's not taking as many of those, but that does need to be a counter for him when the paint is walled off. You know, Al Horford did a good job of defending him. The Celtics sent some other bodies at him, and when he can't get all the way to the rim, he's got to be able to hit that either a pull-up or a runner, or he can hit that from different angles, and he did all right with that today.
Yeah, it was a really weird chart for Giannis. Only 2 of 3 at the rim, 0 of 5 from floater range. Now, he did get to the foul line for 8 out of 12, and some of those obviously were rim attacks. But yeah, then 6 of 9 for mid-range, and he did look very comfortable with that mid-ranger. The three-pointer, he was too aggressive with it again. Yeah. 1 out of 5, back-to-back airballed three-pointers as well. So I think, you know, just dribbling into that mid-ranger where he was more comfortable. Like, I agree, that's an important shot. And maybe if Chris Middleton were healthy, he could get more as the role man, or at least his gravity could open things up. We did see a little bit of that, him running pick and roll with Joe Ingles, getting to his left hand, and Joe got downhill, had a nice fake on Blake Griffin and got a layup because everyone was worried about Giannis trying to roll down the middle of the lane. So maybe we'll see a little bit more of that, but I think also Joe Ingles kind of compromises their defense a little bit as well. And it's kind of, if you're going to play him and Grayson Allen together, I'm also worried, actually, I really have liked what Javon Carter has given these guys this year. And he only got 13 minutes in this one. And I think I actually kind of, he might be, to me, like, I might like him more than Grayson Allen and Joe Ingles. It's just, you have these nightmares for Bucks playoffs past them just not being able to make a three. So it's, and that's where Javon Carter is a little bit of a question mark. But I kind of like the Bucks just leaning into just being incredible on defense. And then, you know, we'll let Giannis and Brooke Lopez and Middleton and Holiday with the occasional step back three carry us home.
Yeah. I mean, Javon Carter, another smaller player that if he ends up on Tatum or Jaylen Brown, I just, once those guys get going, especially, they won't always look this good. But man, it just seemed like those smaller Bucks guards just had no chance of even bothering Tatum and Brown.
Jrue Holiday had an awesome end to the second quarter. Got a couple of steals, hit a step back, a floater. And this is with Giannis out of the game, and that actually got the Bucks back into contact, but Boston quickly restored order. The transition take foul, it's starting to get perverted by the quote-unquote legitimate attempt at the ball. Like, Holiday got away with one of those on a three-on-one, just, you know, ridiculous gamble. Like, just call that a take foul. It's not, but it's not going to. And they were doing that at the start of the year, and then they changed it to not do that, which was killing me.
Yeah, I mean, the incentive now is to just overly aggressive, go for a steal, And if you get the steal, great. And if you foul them, oh, well, that's what you want to do. And this is the way to get away with it. I don't really know how to find the exact balance. And I'm sure we're going to talk more about the transition take foul in a few moments. I thought Marcus Smart had an excellent game. Like, this is how you want your point guard to play when you have Tatum and Jaylen Brown. You know, keep the ball moving. He's not dominating the ball. He has 8 assists. He, in a lot of ways, he looks like sort of that secondary connector, that, you know, secondary creator that who keeps the ball moving and gets it to the stars. You know, he'll go set a screen. Like, this is what you want from Marcus Smart on this team.
Yeah, and I think it didn't start very well, but I think ultimately having him be the full-time point guard for this team really has changed their destiny. It's made them so much better on both ends. And I think Tatum, too, another thing that I've liked about him is, and Smart being able to get him the ball in spots as part of this, is just his ability to catch the ball with a slight advantage and make a quick move, a quick decision. Like, he loves catching the ball and making a quick spin move to his left hand. He had one along the baseline that was really nice when he was kind of trapped. And so his mid-ranger is so good that guys are selling out to stop that, or his three-pointer is so good that if he can make a quick decision when he's got separation and get into the lane, that's something I think he's made like these incremental improvements this year that are really adding up to make him an MVP candidate. I think that's about all I got on this one, though. You know, let's see when the Bucks are healthy. We're hoping we could see Middleton finally, because we didn't see it at all last year, but unfortunately he was out. So, the Bucks are still a really good defense, and Boston absolutely lit them up.
Yeah, just a couple other things to mention. The Bucks shot 13 for 36, which is 36% on three-pointers. I feel like a lot of people thought, oh, that'd be a little higher in the long run with the looks they were getting. I disagree. I thought a lot of the quote-unquote open looks were open because maybe a guy was another couple feet behind the three-point arc than he would like to be, or maybe wasn't completely squared up. I just didn't feel like a lot of those were great in-rhythm looks to be a much higher percentage. Where the Celtics, on the other hand, I felt like they got a lot of – anytime there's like a tip ball or something where there's a little bit of chaos, it just seemed to find its way into a Celtics player's hands beyond the arc, and he'd make the shot, which part of that is luck, but part of that is you just put a bunch of three-point shooters out there. Whenever you do get the lucky bounce, you're really primed to take advantage. And then the one other thing I want to mention, Derek White, he was a team-high plus 20. He hit two or three three-pointers. He had 5 assists. I thought passing is what he did actually well. I did not think he had a very good game, though. I thought he had some defensive struggles, got hung up on screens, got beat on times. He didn't move the ball as quickly as he should. I just praised Marcus Smart for that. I didn't think he was – Derek White is often good at that. I didn't think particularly was, although the plus 20 would disguise it.
Fair enough, yeah, especially with the way the Celtics shoot the ball. I did think that Grant Williams, who was also plus 20 in this game, was fantastic again. You know, his ability to just not get knocked backwards by Giannis and at least force him into a mid-ranger remains impressive. And he hit all 3 of his three-pointers in the big Boston run that put them up 20, end of the third, beginning of the fourth. And his ability to just incremental improvements to pump fake, take a dribble along the three-point line and make those shots just to get his usage up a little bit more. Pretty impressive. He came off the bench in this one, but he's kind of like been a co-starter for this team. And Robert Williams still looks pretty decent. You wonder about him in this specific matchup because they don't really want him to be switching on to Giannis at all. And so he's kind of been easing in. They didn't really need a ton from him. But yeah, I mean, guys who have been really good for this team, Sam Hauser, Peyton Pritchard, Luke Kornet, with everyone healthy for Boston, like, they're actually quite deep at this point.
I mean, by the time like Peyton Pritchard comes in garbage, I'm like, oh yeah, that guy is not a bad player.
Yeah, no, I mean, he would be in the rotation for most teams for sure. We probably didn't even mention Jaylen Brown enough either, with 29 points, 5 of 9 from 3. Again, someone who saw him at Cal, he has worked really hard on his games, over 80% from the line now. He's shooting threes, like coming off of pin downs, like the Drew Holiday's guarding him on a wide pin down. Drew goes under. He just steps back behind the 3-point line, drains it. You know, really just an impressive skill development. Like, he is another guy. He and Tatum both get better every year, which is really impressive. All right, let's talk the final game of the day here.
Our final game.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. I can always count on you for those sorts of corrections. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
That's a perfect segue into transition take fouls.
All right. So you've been champing a bit to talk about this. You texted me about it earlier, so I guess you went back and watched the video. Steve Kerr went ballistic when they tried to foul Steven Adams. I'll try to set the scene. I think it was after a made free throw. Grizz inbound the ball. Desmond Bane is kind of jogging up. Ja Morant throws it back to him. And as that happens, behind the play, an intentional foul is given on Steven Adams. Steve Kerr goes completely apeshit. He gets a technical, and a transition take foul is called even after a made free throw. You rewatched the video. It was reminiscent of something that was in that video, at least to me. I haven't watched it again, though. What are your thoughts?
I don't think this is a... I mean, first of all, I have no idea what a transition take foul is. It's a new rule. The NBA has its wording. I don't know. But the way I read it, I don't see how this is. First of all, in the spirit of the rule, nobody thinks this should be. I mean, this was... Yeah. Here is the rule. It's a transition take foul if it's either one during a transition scoring opportunity. We'll get more to that. I don't think it qualifies as that. Or immediately following a change of possession and before the offensive team has the opportunity to advance the ball. Do we think this was immediately following a change of possession? It was after a made free throw. They had already inbounded it. So I would say this doesn't, to me, qualify immediately following a change of possession.
Well, so a transition opportunity, that video defines it as when the offense is continuously advancing the ball. And once the offense isn't continuously advancing the ball and they get into their half court set, like Bane was kind of jogging up the floor. So maybe that's what they saw. But I think this, again, was maybe more just the referees see that video too. Like that video comes from what Monty McCutcheon and company are telling them. And so we may find out that that was the wrong call in the end, but it didn't surprise me because there was an example of an intentional foul. This one was to like get a guy off the floor due to injury when, you know, in like a relatively mundane situation, it might even been after a missed free throw.
It was after a missed free throw, which I think is a big difference from a free throw make.
Yeah. So maybe it's not a transition take foul.
And it was also before a pass, right? So if you're going to say it's immediate change, I don't know when immediate change of possession ends, but I would say once you pass it ahead, it's no longer
that.
Yeah. Right. And so if we agree it was an immediate change of possession, then it's a transition opportunity. That's when the offensive team is continuing to advance the ball while as an advantage based on the speed of play, the position of defenders, or both. I don't think that was the case either.
Yeah. All right. Well, had it not been for that call, the Memphis Grizzlies, they could have lost by, or the Warriors, they could have won by 16 instead of 14, as it turned out. So let's turn to that. Obviously, the 3-point shooting was number one, 18 of 44 for Golden State. And it wasn't actually their main 3-point shooters. Thompson was 3 of 12. Poole, although he did have 32 before getting thrown out, was 3 of 10. It was the support guys that really went crazy from downtown for Golden State.
Ty Jerome, Anthony Lamb, the two-way contract guys, they had awesome games. Part of it was shooting. You're making your shots. You always look better. But both of them, I thought, passing, defending, putting the ball on the floor for Jerome. Like, I thought both of those guys had excellent games.
Yeah, and for Memphis, I mean, they're just a few of the old bugaboos came out in this game. You know, obviously, 3-point shooting was one of them. You would hope that Desmond Bane, who had a miserable night, 0 for 7 from 3, 2 of 13 overall, he's making his way back. I'm confident that in the aggregate, he's going to hit shots over the course of a playoff series. But they don't necessarily really have anyone else that particularly scares you in that department. And Ja, for all of his brilliance in this game, he went 2 out of 10. His 3-point shooting was great to start the year. Now he's down below 34% after tonight's game. And so that's one issue, obviously, that the Grizz can go cold from the outside. They did that in both of their losses after Ja went down in San Francisco in the playoffs. So that's one issue. The next one is Jaren Jackson Jr. picking up the most asinine fouls, which he's largely avoided this year, but oh my God, were there some, I mean, there were fouls, but just incredibly dumb plays by him.
Yes. 5 fouls in 21 minutes. I think one was offensive, but I mean, just the weirdest, poorly timed grabs, right? And officials. I mean, this was, definitely, the wrong direction for him.
I mean, the few of these, right? Like it's, who was coming down the lane. I think it was like Kevon Looney coming down the lane. He's got two fouls and isn't able to go vertical, tries to block the shot. Like that's one where you go vertical, you make Kevon Looney make a play around you with the two fouls early in the second quarter after you already had to go out. There was the reach in on the DHO, like on the first possession of the third quarter, where he just gets his hand and he definitely reached in, right? And Draymond Green tried the QB keeper, intentionally went right through his arm, and then gave a nice little four signal to the Memphis bench indicating that he had four fouls. And then even the worst one was someone was running. He comes right back in the game, actually makes a couple of plays and picks up his fifth, just like holding the screener who was like trying to flip the angle of a screen, like 25 feet from the basket, setting a screen for like Dante DiVincenzo or something. It was just so it was definitely a throwback to last year. And, they are not going to beat the Golden State Warriors, I don't think, if the Warriors are at full strength. We talk about more about just what that concept even is. But they're not going to beat that team with Jaren Jackson playing 21 minutes. Like, because I think actually the Grizz don't match up as well with Golden State defensively as they did in previous years, because Golden State got a lot of back cuts in this game. This is without Steph Curry too. And part of what made Memphis such a bear for Golden State to deal with was they had all these sharks like Melton. Jackson does fall into that category. Kyle Anderson, guys who just would get their long arms on balls or could come over and make plays at the rim when guys would get open on the back door, and then they would blow the layup or just have to pass out again. And Memphis doesn't have those guys anymore, right? Really, like maybe Zaire Williams could be that. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm going on here. Maybe it's not a point you want to elaborate on, but it does seem like defensively they don't match up with Golden State as well. The hope would be they match up better offensively now.
Well, one area where the Grizzlies do have a pronounced matchup advantage is Ja Morant. No Gary Payton II anymore as I don't know if I want to even say Ja Morant stopper. Ja Morant slower. Dante DiVincenzo, I did not think held up particularly well in that role. Ja Morant, 36 points tonight. He just gets going so fast. You're out of position just a little bit. You blink just a little bit. He is going to take advantage. He's going to get all the way into the paint, finish at the rim. The Warriors could have been sharper defending him, but it does not take much for him to have a crease.
Yeah, he had a big run at the end of the second quarter when the Grizz got back into contact, and a lot of that was in transition. I think he hit either one or both of his threes during that period as well. I thought that other than that, they did a decent enough job on him, forced him into some floaters, which he made pretty well. 36 points, 15 of 29 in 41 minutes, 8 assists, but 6 turnovers. Like that's a number to monitor for him always, but particularly I think going against this team. So Jonathan Kuminga, I think, is an interesting guy guarding Ja. You know, that'll be one possibly to watch as well. But yeah, it'd be nice if they had Gary Payton, but you know, and we didn't get to see a full playoff series of Ja against this team. No Andrew Wiggins in this game either for Golden State. So there's no Steph, no Wiggins. Wiggins remains out with this, seems like a pretty intractable groin issue. Like he was kind of supposed to be back for this game, but the Rick Celebrini didn't think he was ready. So, but yeah, I mean, you've got coming off the bench now, Tyus Jones, like John Conchar is like a rugged individual defender, but he doesn't make plays off the ball as much. Tyus Jones is too small. Santi Aldama, not really athletic enough. Brandon Clark is a terrible matchup against the Warriors. It seems like he always has like some terrible plus minus. He's a team worst, negative 16. What else you got from this one?
Let's talk a little bit more about Jordan Poole. 32 points in 29 minutes. He did shoot 11 of 25. I loved how he got into rhythm by working a lot off the ball, getting easier looks, and got eventually more ambitious. Like you can see the Steph Curry influence. So 32 points. He's not a star. I looked up, when do stars score like this on Christmas? And that's actually fairly common today. When do non-stars score like this? Julius Randle had 35 in his game. Christian Wood had 30. Not a lot of examples of non-stars scoring 30 on Christmas. Patty Mills last year did it for the Nets. Years they were not all-stars. Chris Milton, Jaylen Brown, I don't know if I'm going to count them, but Enes Kanter at the time did it for the Knicks in 2017. Kyle Kuzma did it for the Lakers in 2017.
Yeah.
Before that was Chauncey Billups and the Nuggets.
A laundry list of like guys on teams that shouldn't have been playing on Christmas.
and Jordan Poole and Julius Randle. Well, you can The Knicks would probably deserve it at this point. But yeah, basically, you know, it's it was three guys today and three guys in the previous, like, decade plus. But I had some higher ambitions for whatever pool stat I could come up with, and then he got ejected, and that ended his scoring.
Yeah, that was interesting. You know, it wasn't, like, tremendously efficient for him, but he got 8 free throw attempts, did have 5 turnovers, 11 to 25, but...
You need a volume guy without Curry.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, you felt like maybe Memphis could get back into it down, you know, 16, 18 when he got ejected, but they never really got it under double digits. But you mentioned Poole's cutting, and I thought that was, you know, Memphis loves to topside. That's the way they play against Golden State, where you're just preventing guys from coming up towards the ball, but the back door is open, like Zaire Williams, Dylan Brooks, like those guys guarding Clay, guarding even DiVincenzo, who was excellent with 5 of 9 from three in this one and has been really good all year for Golden State, and guarding Poole. And I thought those guys just, they cut really, really hard. And they just kept moving really hard without the ball. Van Gundy even talked about it. And I thought that was really important to get some of those system buckets. I also thought Draymond Green, even though he only had 3 points, had 13 assists and 13 rebounds. And you can tell, like, his pace pushing the ball up, like, you can tell when he's engaged. And frankly, in this era when the Warriors are going to play well, when he pushes the ball up quickly a lot, even after make sometimes, like, that just shows he's engaged. I thought he had a great defensive game, too, with some of his closeouts, individual defense. So that was pretty important as well.
You already complimented a lot of the parts of his game I wanted to get to, but I do want to talk about the 3 points. It was early in the second quarter. It was early in the second quarter. The Warriors had a Ty Jerome, Klay Thompson, Anthony Lamb, Jonathan Kuminga, Draymond lineup. You kind of wonder how the offense is going to flow with that. They had a real ugly possession. They were on their way to another when Draymond had an open three-pointer. And you know Draymond doesn't want to shoot three-pointers, but he just took it because I think he sensed that that was as good of a look as that unit was going to get, and that's what he made. And so I got a stat, and I know he's gotten a lot of credit for what he's done with those second units. When the Warriors are playing with no Curry and no Poole, when they have Draymond Green on, their offensive rating is 152. Without Draymond Green, it's 112. Obviously, we're dealing with a small sample there, but I do think there's some truth to, like, those units are helpless without Draymond, and he is so smart in figuring out what to do to get those things going offensively when you don't have Curry or Poole.
Yeah, and I think also Ty Jerome and Anthony Lamb are probably the two best two-way guys in the league, which is pretty fucking important when they basically have, you know, Wiseman hasn't been playing, although I do want to talk about him briefly. Andre Iguodala wears some really stylish sweaters on the sideline so far, but doesn't seem like his debut is imminent. You know, Ryan Rollins is completely unplayable. And then they, for tax reasons, they didn't sign a 15th guy. So if they didn't have those two guys able to, like, come in and not kill them, like, they would be in even bigger trouble. Like, Jerome, 14 points and 2 of 4 from three. He, I think, had a personal 8-0 run during the Warriors 11-0 run that took it from tied to basically deciding the game late in the third. And Lamb, too. I mean, like, they're just some of the plays that he knows how to make, in addition to making threes and being passable on defense, where, you know, he knows to step up to the ball when guys are being pressured and then look backdoor, you know, things that guys who, you know, like a Kelly Oubre type would have never known, but because he knows how to play, he can make a few of these plays and, like, keep their system running with Draymond. You know, he's a nice fit with Draymond on that second unit as well.
Yeah. When we talked about all the Jaren Jackson Jr. fouls, the officiating was bad in this game. I don't like to talk officiating much, but it was noticeably bad. There was one where Jaren Jackson fouled Wiseman on a screen and Clay had the ball, and then they gave the free throws to Clay. And then
that was the fifth foul on Jackson. Yeah, that was, I was like, what's going on? Yeah.
And they didn't talk about it until after Clay took the first free throw. And at that point, I wonder if they just felt like it was too late or if they were, I don't know what they were thinking. What's the point of even talking about the first free throw? Cause I don't think you can fix it at that point. I think you should be able to. Like, if you got it wrong, like, you let the wrong guy shoot a free throw, whatever, just fix it. I don't know. I mean, that was particularly bad, in just, like, an easy to digest way, but overall officiating was pretty poor.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, I'm not going to, like, shovel dirt on the Grizzlies after this game. You know, it's the last game of a long road trip, 9 of 39 from three. Like, they could shoot better than that. Desmond Bane is just getting his rhythm back. You know, Dylan Brooks did have five fouls, five turnovers, and four made shots out of 12. That wasn't too good.
And had Klay Thompson dancing on him at the end. I mean, look, to me, the takeaway of this game was Warriors have no Steph Curry. They've got no Andrew Wiggins, but they got some pride. The Grizzlies have been talking a lot. The Warriors wanted to win this, even shorthanded, and they did. I mean, that to me says something.
No, I think so. And as much as, you know, so I still think the Grizz, you know, once Bane gets back, I think they're gonna take off. I think they're in pretty good position. And Golden State now has this 8-game homestand. They won the first one. They're now at 16-18. Steph, the report said he's going to be reevaluated in 2 weeks. So that'll be kind of towards the end of this homestand. You know, maybe he'll be playing again in three, possibly. So, you know, if they could go 6-2 on this homestand, 5-3, like they played a lot more road games at this point. They looked so pathetic at the end of that road trip against the Knicks and Nets. But yeah, you know, it seems like at least, and Poole is starting to find it at least a little bit now. He hasn't been totally consistent, but they play some easier teams on this homestand as well. So this game just makes you feel better, particularly if Wiggins can come back, about their ability to win games as they did without Steph Curry at the end of last season. And they've gotten a lot from DiVincenzo. And last thing, too, I want to talk about James Wiseman. Steve Kerr was piling on the superlatives on Wiseman's defense. He played great defense. Great. And I can't go that far, but he was +8 in 8 minutes. And I thought he did, even though he didn't do anything on offense, he did have 5 defensive rebounds in 8 minutes. And he didn't have any blocks, but he did successfully challenge, I think, 4 or 5 shots at the rim while only committing 1 foul. And I had talked to some people at the G League Showcase from the team and outside of the team saying, like, you know, it was really good for him to just get more of the nuances of drop coverage and how to challenge at the rim and stuff like that. And I did see this was one of the better, this damning with faint praise, one of the better defensive games that he's played. Like, he actually had a positive effect on the game, which, given where he has been in his career, like, that is a step forward for James Wiseman.
I thought you put that very well. I didn't know Kerr said all that. That's obviously over the top. But if we're comparing it to James Wiseman's own baseline, yeah, it was better. It was far better than that.
All right. Well, I gave us the target of finishing this in 45 minutes. It is now not Christmas anymore. So let's wrap it up here. Thanks so much for being a subscriber. Merry Christmas or happy holidays to all of y'all as well. And we'll be back. It's going to be a lighter week this week, but we'll get you 2 more shows this week as well. We usually go a little lighter between Christmas and New Year's with everyone on holiday. And we'll talk to y'all in a couple of days. Till then.
Still Hanukkah, though.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.